Scars Left Behind, podcast episode 26. Virginia becomes 12th state Latina volunteer and revolutionary. Virginia has become the 12th state to ban the use of the gay / trans panic defense. Governor Ralph Northam signed a bill Wednesday against the defense, which has allowed those accused of homicide to receive lesser sentences by saying they panicked after finding out the victim's sexual orientation or gender identity. The bill passed the state house and the Senate in February. The bill's author, Democratic Delegate Danica Roem, said she first became aware of the defense after Matthew Shepard, a gay man, was murdered in 1998, and the men who killed him used the defense in court. According to the American Bar Association, then in 2004, one of the four men who were convicted of killing Gwen Araujo, a trans teenager, also used it. Roem was a college freshman and knew she was trans. When she read about Araujo's death, it terrified her. But what made her determine to introduce a bill to ban the defense in Virginia was a letter she has received from a 15-year-old LGBTQ constituent. "He's out and he sent me an email asking me to pass this bill, and I came to realize that in 2021, my out teenage constituents are living with the same fear that I did in 1998, after Matthew was killed, and that I did in 2002, after Gwen Araujo was killed," Roem said. "And you think of how many other people will stay closeted because they have a fear of being attacked, let alone all of the other fears that a closeted person who wants to come out has." Roem said that, as a researcher who studies the LGBTQ panic defense, testified that it has been used at least 8 times in Virginia. She said some Virginia lawmakers questioned it, arguing that other legal defenses aren't banned, which Roem said is not true. "We went through the list," she said. "The rape shield law, you cannot blame a rape survivor or a rape victim's past sex life, more or less, for that person's rape in that encounter. Their sexual history is relevant. In addition, committing statutory rape against someone 14 or older and then marrying that person does not exonerate the rapist. The marriage is not a viable defense in court. What we were showing was sometimes things are so egregious that when we have this universal acknowledgement that this shouldn't be happening, we codify that," she said, "and so that's what we did with this bill." Though only 12 states have banned the defense, it's still progress, and she said it's a sign that the makeup of the state legislature is changing. In Vermont, Taylor Small, who was elected to the state house in 2020 and is the state's first openly trans legislator, introduced a similar bill there. "You'll notice with me introducing this bill, with Taylor Small introducing this bill in Vermont, that as more of us who are coming from the very communities that are most affected by legislation like this have that lived experience that we were bringing to the table, we are able to speak to this. Having more openly LGBTQ representatives, particularly trans people, affects whether constituents feel like their concerns will be heard. In my case, my teenage constituent, who knows that his delegate is trans and he, as someone who's out, feels safe talking to her, can send me a bill idea and say, 'Delegate Roem, can you carry this? Can you make this happen?' And my answer to that constituent, my answer is yes, and we did. As the first southern state to pass a ban on the defense, also sets an example for other states." She said Virginia banned the defense before Vermont, Maryland, and Massachusetts, though both Vermont and Maryland are considering similar bills. Roem said that once Delaware gets on board, She hopes the Mid-Atlantic states can send a message to LGBTQ people. I hope that as a region, the Mid-Atlantic can really tell people that you are welcome here because of who you are, and we will protect you here because of who you are. William said, the delegate also said that if an LGBTQ person is killed or hurt, the state will not let them use your mere existence as an out LGBTQ person or the perception of you being LGBTQ be a reason that they can hurt you. Next segment. In less than a month, Selena Herrera registered over 600 people to get COVID-19 vaccine appointments in Texas, Rio Grande Valley area. Her volunteer initiative began when Herrera, 26, took it upon herself to register her relatives because she was the tech-savvy one in her family. There were just so many barriers, and this is the solution I had, said Selena, who lives in the Rio Grande Valley. I could offer this. Selena Herrera, on her phone, working to schedule COVID-19 vaccine appointments for Texas residents, courtesy Selena Herrera, in less than a month, the Texas resident figured out that if her Latino family had trouble finding appointments, and she had time to do it, she could register others who might have difficulty doing so, such as native Spanish speakers, the elderly, or people with disabilities. There are just so many barriers, and this is the solution. I've been fortunate enough to be able to catch these appointments for them, and I just have to thank and my really fast thumbs and super speed internet, which I know many people may not have, she said. Sitting in her living room on her iPhone, Herrera uses a Google form she created at the beginning of March to schedule the appointments. It includes basic contact and health information, as well as how far the applicant is willing to travel to get a vaccine. Her daily routine involves working on this during her lunch hour or in the evening after her full-time job, which involves providing quality assessment for caseworkers who work with clients enrolled in government programs like SNAP or Medicaid. Her weekends are solely dedicated to going through her Google form to facilitate appointments, she said. The majority of her applicants are Latinos, which isn't surprising given they account for the overwhelming majority of the population in the Rio Grande Valley, a region on the southern border of Texas above Mexico. Many of the people she signed up came through people she knew. Sometimes an applicant was signed up by a relative who didn't know about her work, so they were surprised or taken aback when she'd informed them of their appointment. To reassure people they could trust her, she put a brief bio on her form. Many experts have said that the best way to get vaccines to hard-to-reach communities is through trusted sources, which also protects people from potential scammers. The CDC and government officials have issued warnings about people soliciting money or personal identification information to make appointments to turn out to be fake. People should be cautious about clicking on links, downloading anything, and turning over identifying information online or by phone without carefully checking out the legitimacy of who is asking for the information. The main barrier for residents has been the limited appointment times. Most residents have been going to vaccination sites where they distribute wristbands on a first-come, first-served basis, but require people to wait in line for hours. It's disappointing for them when they turned away, Herrera said. They often have to take time off from work, and transportation requires planning out the logistics, an even more difficult feat if they don't own a car. Residents who fill out her form provide their information and preference. Herrera fixes for appointments online, looking on company sites like CVS and Walgreens that are offering vaccines until she finds one that matches their distance, preference and availability. Once she confirms their spot, Herrera texts or calls them in Spanish, if that's their native language, where she often hears a huge sigh of relief. People offer me things and I'm like, no, it's okay, it's no big deal, she chuckled. The number of applicants come in waves, and when asked about the specific number of people she's registered, she's lost count after 440, but it's certainly above 600 by now. Herrera expects that number to change by next week. And though she doesn't see this going on for the rest of the year, if more keep coming, she's happy to keep doing it. For every person I'm helping, that's one less person that's reaching out or that needs to be vaccinated. Herrera expressed disappointment with what she sees as Texas' lack of leadership in protecting residents from the coronavirus pandemic. The Lone Star State, as of Friday, had recorded nearly 2.8 million COVID-19 cases and over 48,500 related deaths, according to a running NBC News tally. In the counties included in the Rio Grande Valley, Star, Hidalgo, Willacy and Cameron, there have been nearly 105,000 COVID-19 confirmed cases reported since March 2020. The average percentage of those vaccinated with at least one dose was 43.2% as of Friday. Even though Texas holds the second highest number of confirmed cases in the country, Governor Greg Abbott, a Republican, lifted the state's mask mandate, rescinded most of his COVID-19 executive orders, and allowed businesses to open 100% on March 10th. The decision has led to tensions with some local governments, including a high-profile clash after the state's attorney general sued Austin officials for refusing to enforce the governor's order to end the mask mandate. Herrera is thankful that most residents in her community are still wearing masks. She also relieved, now that she has received her second vaccine dose, she was eligible due to a chronic condition and was able to schedule an appointment in early March. Though it was an hour away from her home, she is more at ease now and hopes to be able to help drive some people to their vaccine appointments if transportation is a barrier for them. Herrera wants others to have that same sense of security. I just feel good and I know I can share that with people I'm helping. Once they get the vaccination, I hope they feel that too. That relief, that weight lifted from their shoulders, she said, that this is the next step they're taking to protect themselves. Next segment. Where there was absence, Joan E. Biron saw potential. As a lesbian and photographer in the early 1970s, Biron, who goes by Jeb, said she was dismayed at the dearth of images that truly reflected her life and the lives of so many in the lesbian community. So, around 1970, she borrowed a camera from a friend and simply held it out at arm's length as she and her lover at the time kissed. While the image wouldn't look out of place today, it was a radical act at the time. Jeb, who is 76 years old, declared it her first lesbian photograph. It was that self-portrait that would launch her on a photographic odyssey to visually document the lesbian community. The years-long endeavour culminated in her self-publishing a book of photographs, Eye-to-Eye Portraits of Lesbians, in 1979. Now, the book has been reissued by Anthology Editions for the first time since its initial release. Eye to Eye had a profound impact for its time. Seeing the photos was a revelation. Each one, said Mary Farmer, who ran the feminist bookstore Lamas Woman's Shop in Washington, D.C., seeing them all together, it was a beautiful thing. It was a revolutionary step for her to put herself out there like that. It was not just Jeb who put herself out there, but all of the women who agreed to be featured in the book. Two, the book was an act of bravery at a time when the risk for consequence was high and greater societal acceptance was still a ways away. I think people don't understand how frightening that could be because of the kinds of things that could happen to you that were completely legal at the time, and they happened all the time. Jeb said. People were shunned and shamed by their families and their friends. They were fired from their jobs. They could not rent apartments people were afraid of being deported if they were here on visas. Despite all of that, Gerber said she found women who were willing to declare and live their truth. Eye to Eye is a celebration of lesbians in the fabric of their lives. Photographically, the book is a mixture of black and white portraiture and candid images that recalls much of the great documentary photography of the 20th century. Jeb said she came to photography in a roundabout way, as she was entirely self-taught, whereas a great deal of 20th century photography saw photographers going to other communities. She photographed her own community, and that proximity imbues her images with emotional weight. It also made lesbians visible to each other. Lesbian women were so invisible, even to one another, depending on where you lived, said Lisa Vogel, 64, who appears in two photographs in the book. Gerb said she was largely mission-driven in creating what would become Eye to Eye. She didn't think at all about profitability. Rather, she was concerned with cultivating and elevating a history that she felt had been ignored. The truth is that while I was making this work, I knew it was important, and I was getting no recognition at all from the mainstream. It was not just recognition that she didn't have, but also institutional support. Making this work was a hard, scrabbled process, and once she got the funds together to pay a publisher, 30 years before Kickstarter existed, she was asked to get a second round of releases from the women she photographed, because it was inconceivable that women would publicly affirm themselves as lesbians in a book. This, of course, caused some women to second-guess their participation and ultimately back out, but enough agreed a second time. Lesbian women were so invisible even to one another, depending on where you lived. Looking back, Jeb said she has lived a life without regrets, but if there is one thing she wishes she could have done, it would have been to photograph lesbian communities around the world. Without money and institutional support, however, she was unable to make that happen, yet her work helped to make it possible for subsequent generations of photographers like her to tell their own stories. For me, this is very exciting, she said. It makes me a proud foremother.
Our podcast episodes, you can find us on Spotify, Acast, Pocket Cast, Acast, Apple Podcast, Amazon Music, and Breaker. Also, you can find us on Instagram at Scars Left Behind. That's behind without the E.